Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This episode of the Steve Austin Show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline.ag. August keeps moving along, and the sports action this summer keeps heating up with tons going on in the UFC, Major League Baseball, and now the NFL preseason. Get in the mix at BetOnline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California today. I'm glad to be back. We'll be playing some of the most requested Steve Austin Show classics that have been locked away in the archives. I got a great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
What's up, folks? It's producer Sean bringing you yet another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Today, we're doing Jesse the Body Ventura, episodes number 369 and episode number 371. Original air dates October 18th, 2016, and October 25th, 2016, respectively. We're going to combine these two episodes into one massive ep, focusing on the wrestling aspect of things, as, of course, Jesse, a fellow WWE Hall of Famer, along with Steve, talks a lot about his respect and reverence for superstar Billy Graham, how Billy Graham ended up influencing a lot of what Jesse's character was that we've come to know and love in wrestling. Also, how the Navy SEALs training and his underwater demolitions experience prepared him for pro wrestling. That's a pretty interesting comparison he does share there. As well as getting into some of the nuts and bolts of managing your copyright. As many people know, Jesse Ventura had copyright issues with the WWE in the 1990s, 1990 to be exact, and there was some contention over the use of the Jesse the Body Ventura name that Jesse does talk about in this podcast, and you get to hear how that kind of shakes down. Also, Jesse talks about working on Predator, the difference between Vince McMahon Jr. and Vince McMahon Sr., as well as getting into broadcasting as the WWE announcer that many of us grew up with. And he also touches on some of the discussions about wrestling unions. And also around this time, Jesse was promoting his book, Jesse Ventura's Marijuana Manifesto, How Lies, Corruption, and Propaganda Kept Cannabis Illegal, which you can still find today on Amazon and other places you get your books. So yeah, pretty loaded episode today on the classic episode with Jesse the Body Ventura. And of course, please check out your dude, Steve Austin, and his new show, Straight Up Steve Austin, Monday nights after Raw. He just had the debut this past week with Rob Riggle as his guest, and this coming week is going to be Sal Vulcano from the Impractical Jokers. So definitely check that out on the USA Network. All right, let's get into it. This day in Steve Austin history, today being August 15th. We start off in 1992 for WCW in Jacksonville, Florida. It's Ricky Steamboat defeating stunning Steve Austin. Then in 1994 at a WCW pro taping in Dalton, Georgia. Check out this match, and I really hope this finds a way to resurface somehow on the Hidden Gems, or maybe it's already there. I don't know. The new network interface is kind of screwy, so maybe this match is already there. Sting and Ricky Steamboat defeated WCW World Champion Ric Flair and WCW US Champion Stunning Steve Austin. That sounds like a hell of a tag match. And then finally, in 1998 in St. Louis, Missouri, it's WWF World Champion Stone Cold Steve Austin defeating The Undertaker and Kane in a triple threat match. I get my information from the history of WWE.com. All right, folks, thanks for listening. And coming right up, we've got another classic episode for you with Jesse the Body Ventura here on the Steve Austin Show.
As the month of August continues on, the action across the sports world continues to heat up with the NFL preseason already underway. Nothing better when football is back. Check out what's on deck this week in the NFL. It's Packers versus Ravens, the Chiefs versus Steelers, the Cowboys versus Rams, and the Saints versus Chargers. And there's only one place that has you covered and one place we trust, betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use the promo code podcast1 or text BETNOW to 238-669 to receive a 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partners of Podcast One Sportsnet.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
How do people take you over there?
Where? In Mexico?
Yeah, in Mexico in general. I mean, you've been down there for so long now. The
I'm just a big gringo.
Right.
But I mean, in fact, I went to a thing.
No issues, no fears. I mean, you have a guard dog.
Yeah, never have used him.
But was your wife on board with you when you went down there?
Yeah.
How have you been married since 1975?
How?
I mean, to be a successful pro wrestler, a successful politician, a best-selling author, through all the trials and tribulations of all those three lives?
Yeah.
What is the key? What is the key?
The first key is love your wife. And realize that she's part of you and you can't get along without her. And my wife is my partner. And if I lose her, I've lost half of me. I couldn't do what I do without her. I don't have an entourage. I don't have all that. My wife does the computer. My wife books me. My wife is my assistant.
Right.
As well as my lover, as well as my partner. And she's been that way. You'll remember in my world of wrestling, I was a loner.
Right.
I didn't hang out. I didn't go to the bars. You know, I was a loner. And I did that for many reasons. I learned early on that, you know, generally anytime something happens after midnight, it's not going to be good.
Well, true. When did you meet your wife?
I met her
after. You got into pro wrestling, what, 75?
Five.
You started with Sharky.
Yeah.
You got on the road, went down to Kansas City.
Yeah, well,
This is coming out of the Navy SEALs.
Well, I met her in between. I had come out of the Navy, and I rode with the Mongols for a while, and then I went back home, and I went to junior college for a year not knowing what I was going to do. I was on the GI Bill. And I thought about pro football because it was actually at the time when the NFL had that first strike. Back in the 70s. Yeah. So they were hiring scabs. And I thought about it. I thought, God, I should just try out for the Vikings.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah.
But I knew the gold guys would be back. And once they came back, then I'd lose my eligibility. I wouldn't be able to play in college because I'd be a pro at that time. So I went to junior college with the intent of playing JC football and then getting a college scholarship to a big school. Well, it was while I was in college in the weight room, all the guys were wrestling fans and they would go to the matches. And it was a little before that, I was introduced to an infamous character by the name of Superstar Billy Graham. And I don't care what anybody says, Superstar Graham had more influence on young wrestlers at that time than anyone. Hulk Hogan, me. Graham was the first bodybuilder type that came in kissing biceps and doing all I did was steal Billy's gimmick.
Right.
And in fact, Vern Gagne had me do it. When I came to the AWA, the first thing he said to me is, can you do Superstar Graham? I said, I can do it better than he can. And Vern goes, that's what I want, because he had just lost Graham, and he needed a replacement for him.
But speaking of Superstar Billy Graham, you know, his style in the ring, your style in the ring, when it comes to promos, he had that kind of lift along the lines of a Dusty Rhodes type thing, but you had your voice, and it was kind of still an evolution as I watched your early promos from AWA until it ended up with your commentary with WWF and where it is now. But just going through the paces, have you always had the gift of gab?
I think so, and I think I got it from my dad.
Really?
Yeah, because I dedicated my previous book to my mother and father. And
they both served in World War II.
Yeah, they're both WW2 veterans.
What kind of parents were they?
Great parents. They were working parents, though.
Right.
I was a latchkey kid.
But what values did they instill in you?
Like independence.
Independence.
Being able to take care of yourself, that nobody's going to look out for you but you. And my parents were very independent. I left let's finish the wife story. It was in that transition that, I took a second job working as a bouncer. And I was in wrestling training and I had gone so boldly, I had already bleached my hair blonde. just as a lark with my buddies at college, because we'd go and cheer for Graham and everyone hated us. You know, we'd be down there cheering for the Heels. And so I was bouncing in the bar and this girl came in, and I was still, I'll say, timid, because I had spent 17 months in Southeast Asia. And when you come back to America, there's certain things frighten you. And one of the things that I had hard time relating to was women in the United States. It was just difficult. And so I remember when my wife walked in, I was there with about four cops. We worked this thing, and she walked in and our eyes locked on each other. And I told myself, God, you've got to say something. You've got to get the courage. You've got to find it here. Yeah. There was just something. Well, she got ID'd. So when she got to me, I just said, what? And so I said, excuse me, can I see some ID, please? And she goes, but I just showed him. And I said, and so she dug around, handed me her license, and I saw the name, and it was Teresa, and I handed it back. I said, thank you, Teresa. And I said, I didn't really want to know how old you were. I just wanted to know your name. And that was my pickup line. She came up later in the night, and we started talking. And what really hooked me was I found out her father used to watch wrestling every night, every week on TV. And she remembered when the Crusher was a bad guy,
yeah,
a villain. And I thought, this woman has something here. She knows wrestling. She's a fan. And by that time, I was now focused. I thought, wrestling's for me, because number one, it gives me the athleticism of football. But even bigger, when I was in college, I got interested in theater.
Yeah.
And I did Aristophanes, The Birds, and I loved theater.
So this was the combination.
This combination. And I thought, this is it.
Okay.
This is theater and athleticism combined, and I can create.
But then comes the road.
Yep.
So you got the best of both worlds.
Well, I went down to Kansas City single. And
that was with Central States, right?
Yeah.
Is that Bob Geigel?
Bob Geigel, Pat O'Connor.
I was working with him.
He was great. I like Bob.
Pat O'Connor.
He was a shit.
Shooter? What was he?
Well,
what was the deal?
Pat made me go to the ring with him because I was new. He made me go to the ring with him in the afternoon, and he basically stretched me.
Right.
You know, and I, you know, what would I need that for? I'd already trained for 9 months. Why do I need to be stretched? You know, why? I understand, but and the way they stretched you also got me, because you gave yourself to them.
Yeah,
it's a completely different thing if they tell you, heads up, defend yourself.
Yeah.
Well, I might have did some different things then, you know, other than a wrestling move of locking up the way you're trained,
yeah,
to do it, and then the guy takes you down and stretches you.
Well, it's like those stories I heard from Stu Hart. I mean, you know, the legendary Stu Hart,
yeah,
right? I mean,
yeah,
the dungeon.
Sure.
You know, you're basically giving yourself to him, and, you know, hey, how's that kid? How's that? So you're being stretched by the guy, but you're there, and then you're going to go to AWA later. But what were you working as then down there with Pat O'Connor, working for Geigel?
Heel.
Were you working heel? What was your name?
Surfer Jesse Ventura. Because I wanted to be from California, and I surfed when I was younger in the Navy and all that. And I thought, who do they hate more than a beach bum? Which is what they classify a surfer, even though they're not. It's like surfing's like a religion, and that you wouldn't call a religious bum. You know, but so I thought, surfer Jesse Ventura is a great from San Diego, California, bleach blonde hair, just sits on the beach with women all day. He's this guy that can kick everybody's butt, but yet when the going gets tough, he's a coward.
But you were already thinking about this at the formative years, man.
Oh, yeah.
I was riding down the road in Tennessee, and, you know, Dutch Mantell had already called me Stunning Steve Austin. That was a cocky, arrogant heel.
Sure.
That was end of it. I didn't put anything behind the gimmick. You were already thinking about the showbiz aspect of it. You know, before, you were probably even mechanically inclined. I mean, because you just came out of wrestling school.
Yeah.
So you're not going to be the greatest yet.
Right.
But you're forward thinking, because you're already thinking about the gimmick.
Do you know what made me feel good? I had my first match in Wichita, Kansas, and I'll never forget it, with Omar Atlas. Do you know him?
No.
Hell of a good little worker, you know, stocky built, Latino guy, Omar Atlas. And Geigel come up to me that night, and he says, well, kid, you know, nobody wins their first match. I said, I know. He turns to Omar, said, Omar, this is this kid's first match. He said, take care of him out there. And he gave Omar the option. He said, if the, Geigel says, if the match is the hit him with two drop kicks and cover him, one, two, three. He said, if the match is good, have him throw you out over the top rope, because in those days, that was a disqualification. Yeah. So he left it to Omar. Omar could have put himself over. We got through with the match, or during the match, came time, Omar whispers to me, oh, over the top, kid. And so I tossed him over the top, kept my heat. Of course, you lose, but you don't really lose, because he's on the floor, you're prancing around. But I always respected Omar for that. I thought, here's a guy who saw my potential, and he didn't put himself in front of it. So years later, when I was broadcasting for Vince, Omar used to come in as one of the job guys. I would put him over on the mic. Unbelievable. No matter if he lost, I still made him look good on the mic. And I thought, here's payback, Omar.
Right.
For you taking care of me, I'm taking care of you now.
I remember, when, I want to jump ahead just with a quick story. In 92, when you came to WCW, one of the things I was so thankful for was, maybe you were just doing your job, but you always took care of me down there.
Because I liked you.
I know.
I saw
I
talent in you.
I never forgot it.
Well, no, I saw a talent. When I went to WCW, and I'll tell you honestly, I went there just for the money.
Right.
They gave me big money to come down because I was a steal from Vince.
Correct.
You know, and Vince booted me out. You know why, don't you?
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't sell my copyrighted likeness to him.
I didn't know that was the final straw.
Oh, yeah. The final straw was I own Jesse the Body Ventura. I own the copyright of it, and I refused to let him have it without him giving me some type of royalties for it. And that was and I had a video game at the time that was interested in using me, and Vince wouldn't let me do it. And so that's when I quit and left him, because I said, Vince, you don't own me. I own me. I was Jesse the Body before I ever came here.
I have that in my notes. When did you copyright Jesse the Body Ventura? Because nobody at that time had the wherewithal to trademark something. That was probably the first time ever.
I don't know. I just did it in the early 80s when I took the name, because I thought, I don't want anybody having this but me. I want to own. I'm Jesse Ventura. I made the name up. I love the name Jesse. I wanted to be from California, so I matched it up to a map. And when I saw Ventura, it had the ring. So I created it, and so I felt I deserved the creator, the copyright of it. So I don't know why, but I had enough sense to know copyright this with the federal government. And so Vince could never own my name. He had to license it through me.
But was it the video game that was the tipping point?
Yep.
And the fact that you wouldn't sell the name?
Yep.
God dang it.
And that's what he let me go. He couldn't allow anyone out of the circle.
Right.
And then the reason I beat him in court was he could have won, because he's not required to pay royalties. But it came out in court certain people were getting royalties. It's called quantum merit.
Yes.
Hogan got royalties. Cyndi Lauper got royalties. Mr. T got royalties.
But they were kayfabe and everybody else.
Yep. And they lied.
They had to take care of
and they lied in negotiations, because if you'll recall, when the night I went into the Hall of Fame, I said, the thing I'm most proud of is the fact that I was the first wrestler that introduced Vince to an agent.
Yeah.
And, oh, God, you should have seen Vince out in the crowd. He was ready to punch me. You know, if that's the thing he wants to be remembered for. But it worked, because my agent protected me.
But you only got the agent because of Predators, right?
Yeah.
A Predator.
Yeah. But I had to quit Vince.
Right. You told him, hey, man, it's too good of a gig.
Well, did you hear the story?
Yeah.
About how Vince wasn't going to let me do it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I had to quit. I said, I quit. I said, who's going to get a chance to co-star with Arnold? I said, I can always come back to wrestling. I said, I quit. So I left. And then it was during then that Arnold approached me about the Running Man. And so I inked that before Vince sent word he wanted to talk to me, because NBC Main Event was hitting on him. Where's Jesse Ventura?
They bought it with you.
With me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't there. And so I waited till I signed the Running Man and had it in my pocket for the fall.
Right.
Then I went to Vince and I told him, well, Vince, I'm not going to talk to you unless you talk to my agent. He handles my career completely, and you're the only one that he doesn't. And Vince argued, and I said, well, it ain't good enough. Here's his number. So Vince, of course, he didn't do it. He got somebody else to act as his agent. But they lied, because every year I'd negotiate, we would ask, what about videotape royalties? We don't pay them. Well, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to lie during a negotiation. Yeah. And that's how I won the case. And I call it, Steve, my wrestling retirement, because I've gotten quarterly checks since 1990, whatever it was.
Right.
And some of them are pretty healthy.
Yeah.
They're not so big today because it's years have gone by, but I've gotten checks that are upwards of six figures in royalty payments. And I call it my book. I said, I'm the only wrestler that has a retirement.
Going to the,
that's why Vince won't bring me back, like to the Manias, like he'll bring you back and all this. He won't bring me back because then by law, he's required to pay me royalties if he produces it.
We're right. I want to go back. We're going to end up talking about the 2009 Raw that you returned to
and sure.
You're the guest GM. But when I left the business, and I didn't know what I was going to do, and when I left the business, I wasn't ready to. My neck was telling me, hey, you need to get out of here.
Yeah,
so for 3 years, I just kind of did nothing in San Antonio. A lot of hunting, fishing, and like I said, quite frankly.
Fortunately, drinking. You made a lot of money, though.
Yes, sir.
So you're
correct.
In good shape there.
And I was in good shape. But I figured, hey, man, it's time to get off your ass and get out to L.A. Do something. Because before, you know, I was in the wrestling business, I was driving a forklift. And the wrestling game teaches you a lot of things, but it doesn't qualify you for anything
nothing.
Else in life.
Nothing. So, you know when I faced that, Steve? When I had the blood clots.
Yes.
The night before Hogan.
Right.
I laid in bed going, I had two children, and I'm going, if I can't wrestle again, what do I do? You know, 3M's not going to hire me.
No.
You know, and I'm not qualified to do anything.
But when I came out to Los Angeles, I started taking some meetings, and I would get this time after time. You know, we were trying to get a hold of you back when you were with the WWF because we wanted you in this or that or whatever.
And they didn't
and I'm
tell
like,
you.
Are you kidding me?
They didn't tell you.
You're right. I was so hot, I was pulling the wagon. So if you got a lead horse pulling the wagon, you don't want your lead horse going off and doing what you were able to do.
Yep.
So missed opportunities, but
you know what finally got it for me? I let Vince in when I did the first episode of Hunter, the TV show
yes.
with Freddie Dreyer,
yeah.
And I got my royalty or my check for it, and Vince took 40% commission,
producer's fee, executive,
and I said that's ridiculous. Nobody takes more than 10. Well, how the hell does this guy take? Because I found out Barry, my agent, called me and said, did you get your check from Hunter? I said, yeah, I got mine. And I said what I got. And he went dead silent on the other end. I said, why, Barry? What was the payment supposed to be? He said, well, you better call the WWF and have him say I can talk money. So I called Ed Cohn. I said, yeah, I threatened him. I said, Ed, you call Barry Bloom and tell him he can talk money with me or I'm going to beat the shit out of you next time I see you. And so he called Barry and says, yeah, you can. And then I found out I had a $1,500 payoff and Vince paid me $700. That's what it was. Barry Bloom got his 10% cut and Vince my check was for $700 when the payoff was $15. Barry Bloom got $150. Vince took the rest. And I thought, I'm eliminating him. He didn't do nothing. I got this part. He had nothing to do with it whatsoever.
When you first got out, you've always said that pro wrestling got you ready for politics, got you ready for acting because of being behind the stick and
sure.
just on the gig.
Yep.
Did being in the Navy SEALs help you for professional wrestling?
Oh,
like
yeah.
Physical specimen?
It not only did it make me physically prepared for it, it made me mentally prepared
right.
for it because the thing that going through BUDS or basic underwater demolition SEAL when you graduate, because only about 25 to 20% of the
right.
people make it, the thing that really instills in you is the will never to quit. That no matter how tough it going or how sad you're feeling for yourself, most of the time it's your own sadness that's doing it. Pick yourself up. You've been, whenever I would get in a situation, maybe at wrestling or anything where the going got tough, God, I'd think back to BUDS and going, this ain't nothing compared to lifting telephone poles in the mud when you haven't slept for 2 days.
Right.
You know, what the hell? This is a piece of cake compared to what I was trained and you know, prepared at. But fortunately, I was 18, 19 years old when I did it, and your body can do all that then. But no, I've used my Navy training. It's also made me punctual. I'm the type of person that I do not like arriving not on time. And that comes right from the military, because in the military, if you're told to be there at 8 o'clock, you're there at 7:55.
Right.
8 o'clock don't mean 8:02. And if that happens to you in the military, you're going to pay a dear price for being late. Late is not accepted in the military.
Listen to you talk. Go back to promos for just a second. I'm jumping all over the place with you. Who did you like listening to in the business? I know Billy Graham.
Graham.
I know. But you know how
much? You know how much I liked Graham? My buddy taped all his interviews on a cassette, and we used to drive around at night, and I'd listen to them over and over and over again.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We had nothing but Superstar Graham interviews, probably a dozen of them, all on a cassette player. And I would, as I drive, I would listen to Graham and listen to his rap and listen to, you know, the way he did it.
Well, with that comes, and a lot of things I like about, you know, his promos, your commentary, or speakers that are running for politics, is cadence, delivery, pacing. You know, when I watch some of the GOP stuff, we'll get into politics in a minute if you want to. But, man, it's speech patterns.
To me, it's natural now.
Well, right. But don't you think that's a key thing, is to try to rope someone in or to command their attention or to keep them riveted? I'm sure you want to have some good content, but if you're very convicted in everything you say. I think that's a big part of a great promo. If you don't believe it, even though it could be totally out of left field or from a heel perspective, who else is going to believe it?
I'll give Vince credit for that in a way.
Saying you could have carte blanche at the gig?
Vince, I'll never forget.
Well, let's pick us up from the blood clots.
Well, yeah.
Pre-Hogan run.
Okay, when I went down with the blood clots, I was due to go around with Hogan in a 3-match program. God knows how much money that cost me.
Right.
I mean, you know, you're talking major league money.
Yes.
With the champ 3-match program, and I lose it. My dear old, the late John Studd replaced me. Bless him.
Yeah.
He would have been probably my first choice if I said, give him the money. You know, yeah. Big John, because I love Big John. We travel together. One of the few guys I would travel with was John Studd. Well, while I was laying in bed, I went through the dilemma of, what am I going to do? If I can't wrestle again, if this is the end of my career, what the hell am I going to do? Go back in the Navy?
Well, yeah, because you're about to blow stuff up.
Yeah, yeah. What am I going to do? Well, then when I was convalescing, and I'll give Vince credit, he paid me while I was out.
Oh, wow.
Not a lot. But he gave me $1,000 a week.
Wow.
You know,
that's unheard of.
Yeah, he paid me.
I got fused up in 2000.
He paid me $1,000 a week. Well, I knew he wasn't going to keep doing that without getting something out of the skin or the hide. So he called me one day, and it was his idea. He said, Jesse, I got an idea, an explosive one. No one's ever put a heel on the mic. He said, do you think you could do color commentating while you recoup? I said, sure, I can do that. And so he came up to me, and I'll never forget the first night I was going out with Monsoon, and Vince comes over to me, and I give him credit. He said, Jesse, here's how I want you to broadcast. This is your mental position. If you believe it, it's true. That's all he said to me. If you believe it, it's true. And he sent me out with that to where I could do anything I wanted, and I really had, for a time, the greatest job in the world, because there was a point I worked one day every 3 weeks. I made unbelievably good money, and I got to insult my boss on a regular basis on nationwide television, and he loved it. You couldn't get in trouble for me insulting the boss.
What was your preparation? Well, first of all,
nothing.
We're talking about talking.
Okay. Nothing.
Okay, before that, no preparation on commentary then?
No.
You just show up and react.
I react. I remember when I went to the first Saturday night main event, NBC. Here we are now with Dick Ebersole, 7 cameras, 9 cameras. NBC's come in. Holy, what is this? And I remember going up to the broadcast thing, and there was this big spiral notebook up there, and I opened it. And it was, Vince says this, Jesse says this, Vince says this, Jesse says this. And I read it, and Dick Ebersole walked by. I said, Dick, come here. I said, what's this? That's your script. I looked at Dick. I says, Dick, I said, 2 years ago, you didn't give a rat's ass about wrestling. I said, now we're the hottest thing out there, and I'm happy you're here. We're all on board. But I said, who in your staff of writers is qualified to write for Jesse the Body Ventura? I know wrestling. They don't. I said, no one. You have no one who can write for me. No one can do it. Only I can. Dick Ebersol was so good and so professional. He sat there a moment, and he kind of furrowed his brow a little. He said, you're right. Push that to the side. Don't even worry about it. I went, thank you, Dick. See, he got it that I respond to what happens in front of my eyes. I can't go on something that's pre-written to do wrestling, and nobody can write and tell me how I would respond to
Nobody.
It. Nobody.
But also, you said, like, in your debates, you, no notes.
No.
In your speeches, whether mayor or governor.
Other than the state of the state.
Okay.
The state of the state, you have to be exact, and you do that off a teleprompter. And you go in and practice it.
But otherwise, you were just straight up ad lib.
Yeah. Always. I never used a prepared
speech.
Do
you have a photographic memory?
No.
You obviously have a great memory.
I don't
know. But you also have the
I have a hard time doing scripts sometimes.
Right.
But no, if somebody writes me a script, I have some difficulty in taking those words into memory.
Okay, because I love Predator so much. I mean,
but Predator's one-liners.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You're lying heavy there. But okay, so then with anything, I don't like memorizing stuff.
The most difficult script I ever did, and I don't know if you've ever seen my episode of the X-Files. Mm-mm. Oh, you need to see my X-Files episode where I play a man in black. And the X-Files, oh boy, is that, they wrote stuff there, Steve, I didn't even know what I was talking about. You know, that, who's the guy that does X-Files? I forget his name. He's real famous now.
Don't ask
me. Well, anyway.
So, but you memorized it all, right?
Yeah.
You just didn't know what you're saying.
Yeah, I just didn't know what I was saying because it was so X-File-ish. It was like, I was a man in black, and it's a great story. It's called Jose Chung. Something or other. And the guy who was in it was Charles Nelson Reilly. Remember him?
Yeah.
He's got one of the lead roles in it. And it's a great episode. It got rated one of the top 10 X-File episodes in history.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question. You do Predator. You got Running Man. I can list a slew of movies you did, some of the television stuff.
Yep.
What said to you, or how did you just say, I'm done with acting. It's time to go do this.
No, I never said it. I didn't make the right choice.
How?
Well, when I was down in Mexico, Arnold said to me one day, Jesse, when are you going to move to L.A. and become one of the boys? And I turned to Arnold, and I had two small children then. My kids were young then. This was the 80s, late 80s. And I said, well, Arnold, I said, how are the schools? And he thought he gave me the best answer, but he gave me the worst one. He looked at me and said, oh, you don't worry about that. You send your kids to private school. Well, to me, I sat and thought, do I want my children growing up in a city where they're required to go to private school, where the public school system is so bad and living there is so bad? In Minnesota, our public school system is award-winning. And I thought, I'm not taking my kids and raising them in L.A. So I didn't move out here. I stayed in Minnesota. And, Steve, it hurt me. Because like anything, you know it out here, out of sight, out of mind. You got to be here. You got to do the negotiating. You got to do the dinners. You got to do all the behind-the-scenes, lack of better term, bullshit.
Right.
You know, you got to do that. I didn't, because of my children, and I don't regret it today at all, I felt my kids were better raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota than they would ever be raised out here. And my son learned quick enough because when he turned 19, guess what his first job was?
What?
He was assistant to Sean Penn. Now, if that don't teach you Hollywood, nothing will. No, my son developed and Sean Penn had him as his assistant for 3 years. He was with him when he won the Academy Award for Mystic River, when he directed Jack Nicholson in The Pledge. My son was right with him, and Sean taught him the ropes of Hollywood. And today, my son got nominated for an Emmy, and he does his own show on Russian TV called The Hawks.
I know when you wrestled, you had a passion for the business because you grew up watching it.
Yeah.
And then it was the best of both worlds, athletically and theatrically. So you got into the business. There was a passion there. Did you have the same passion for acting that you did for the wrestling business? Or was it just something to do because you weren't wrestling anymore, part of the evolution?
No, I had the passion for it, but I didn't have the passion for the networking. I had the passion to do, I loved it. There isn't a more fun thing to do than a movie. I mean,
oh, I disagree.
And I like it. I'll tell you what, I like it when you go to location.
Right.
Because then you become a family. You're all away. I hate doing movies in LA because everybody goes home at the end of the day and you don't. If you don't live here, you go to a hotel. That's why when we did Predator, we were on location in Puerto Vallarta, staying all in one hotel. Then you become a family. To me, there's more camaraderie in the finished product,
right,
of knowing we did this all together from the prop master to the whatever and da 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 da. It required us all to do it.
How was working on Predator? Because I know you had fun. I know you were ribbing Arnold, the Jim stories.
Yeah.
With him and Sven or whoever's bodyguard.
Sven was.
So you get to the gym early, but John McTiernan says, man, when Jesse first came on, and it looked like you were full of piss and vinegar at that time, but he had to dial you down a little bit.
Yeah.
Was it because you were so big because you're used to playing the wrestling audience?
No. No.
What was the story?
It was because I went back.
What do you mean?
I went back. I actually had a few dreams down there.
So you went back to Vietnam?
Uh-huh.
Oh.
Uh-huh. That's where it came from. I was back. The smell.
Oh.
The weapons. The shooting.
Amazing.
I went back. No. Wrestling had nothing to do with it.
Did you ever need a time to say, guys, I can compose myself or what?
I never had to get to that point, but I remember my wife came down and told me that at one point I bolted straight up in the middle of the night and I exclaimed, don't worry, the area's all secure, and then rolled over and went back to sleep again. And she was startled because in our life together I had never had any type of thing like that happen before. But when I went to do Predator, old things came out.
Yeah.
Old. And see, for me, it was an easy movie to do because I just went back to what I was trained to do.
Well, you knew how to do everything.
Uh-huh. And I actually, me and Gary Goldman we were there a week ahead of time and we were the ones that taught them how. Gary's an old Green Beret. And, we taught the patrolling. He would always put me at rear security so I could watch everybody else and then critique at the end. I feel proud because I've had many military people come up to me and say that the patrolling in Predator is the most authentic they've ever seen because we kept our spacing. I used to fight with McTiernan on that. I'd go, you got everyone cramped up. One round in the middle, you lose your whole platoon. What the hell? And I had to learn, we're shooting a movie. We're not doing a documentary. This isn't Navy SEAL training film. This is you're doing a movie for entertainment.
But to that point, you wanted to be authentic if you're going to represent.
Well, that just came out in me.
Yeah.
Because I said, you've got us too crowded together. We're in daylight. We would have 10 meters between us all. You don't want it to where one guy could take out half the platoon.
Oh, I have no tactical training whatsoever, but obviously that makes sense. Had you not had the blood clots, had you done the run with Hogan, had you remained physically healthy enough to stay in the ring, speculation, how much longer would you have stayed in the business?
Who knows? Who knows?
Who knows if you'd ever got to broadcasting? Because to me, as good as you were in the ring, you were 10 times as good on the mic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope that's a compliment.
It's a compliment because in my day of wrestling, I remember old timers would tell me, they'd say, the match doesn't draw for what happens in the ring. The match draws for what's said on the mic. And I took that to heart right away. It's the key is what you say on the mic. The ring work is actually secondary. You have to be able to back it up.
Yes.
But look at how many guys were phenomenal on the mic and couldn't work a lick.
Right, or charisma or crowd psychology, because one of the things I want to ask you, because you're so good at explaining things and just passionate, many people can understand, what do you think is the key to getting over, and let's just say the business of wrestling, it could almost be a parallel of getting an acting business, but let's talk.
And getting elected.
Yes, because like you said, I know you're selling yourself.
The key to me.
Is it talent, charisma? What is it?
Well, it's talent, it's charisma, it's focus, and it's also you have to immediately I would go to the ring and find the first mark I could that would interact with me. and I draw him out, he or she. And the minute you involve the crowd, you got him.
Right.
You got it.
You got it.
I remember people ask me, who is your favorite person to wrestle? And I'd always go Tito Santana.
Because I knew you liked him.
For some reason, Tito and I's style blended perfect, and Tito knew me, knew how I needed to work, and he was so wonderful. He and I, we had cases where the announcer would say 10 minutes gone, and we hadn't touched. And the match was and yet the people had been up and down out of their seats three times, and we hadn't touched.
Right.
Just because, and Tito would allow me to be me, and then his timing was phenomenal. When it was time for him, he trusted me and knew I'd give it to him.
Yes.
Because I knew that you got to give the baby face their due. You know, they got to beat you up at some point so you can be a coward.
But when you called him Chico, the way you said it, and you compared him to Chico and a man, but I figured, man, he's got to be tight with Tito. Because on one hand, it angers the people so much that it's getting him over. His name is Tito. But I just figured you guys were tight.
Oh, yeah. And I did that with everybody because they were all so insignificant to me.
Make sure to stick around after this podcast to get the latest headlines from the AP News Minute.
Hey, Jordan here. I know a lot of you create your own podcasts, and a lot of you already have one like me. I obviously love what I do. It's taken a lot of hard work to get to this point of success. You shouldn't have to pay fees for platform hosting, distribution, analytics, or fees to create a podcast. You need to be able to focus on producing the best show possible. Now, Podcast One, that's a network I'm on, they have Launchpad Digital Media, or Launchpad DM for short. So it's free, includes unlimited hosting, full control of distribution. You have access to a full dashboard with analytics. Again, totally free. You own everything, by the way. You own your content, you own your subscribers, no tricky stuff there. And you get your own show page on launchpaddm.com for people to listen to and subscribe to your show. It's the only hosting platform brought to you by the leading network, Podcast One. Podcast One will promote the site, drive people to discover your podcast, and if your show grows, you could even be invited to join Podcast One's all-star roster, which includes people like Adam Carolla, Caitlin Bristow, Shaq, Lady Gang, and of course, me, Jordan Harbinger. I'm there too. You also get access to their production and sales support. So with all this completely free, don't use other hosting platforms. Why would you need to? Learn more or sign up now at launchpaddm.com. And don't forget to check out the Jordan Harbinger Show.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
You never worked babyface.
Never.
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 Here's
once.
The thing,
no, once.
When?
Once.
Beginning?
Middle. No, okay. Portland. Portland.
Okay.
No, what happened there, I worked babyface for maybe a situation baby, heel turn baby. I had left and gone to Hawaii, and so they worked a split between me and Buddy Rose. I was teamed with Buddy Rose then. So we did a split between Buddy and I. Buddy was staying, so he stayed heel. I actually switched to babyface for that brief program of a few weeks. And then later when they brought me back, Don flew me in right before I worked for Vern. He flew me in because he had lost Snuka and he needed someone to go against Rose. So he flew me in for a two-week program to work with Buddy out in Portland right before I started with the AWA.
But then I'm imagining that was an edgy babyface who was making his return based on the storyline of why you left.
Totally.
Situational.
Situational all the way. Other than that, never did I work babyface.
Okay.
Never was I brought in as one. Never did I want to be one because babyfaces couldn't create.
That's interesting.
As a heel, you could create. Babyface, it was mom, apple pie, and the girl back home. You couldn't insult no one. You couldn't be controversial. And there was the old saying, Steve, from before your day, they got to hate you before they can love you.
Yeah, but I've always felt, though, also, as a heel, you have so much freedom. You can have egg on your face. You can trip on the bottom rope. Not to say you want to be a comedy act, but you can screw up. And it's okay as that baby. I just didn't. Certainly, you had creativity or freedom, not as much
not
as a
much.
Heel. Okay. The original question was,
put it this way, I wouldn't have made no money as a baby face.
Okay, but the original question was your definition explanation of how you get over. Because, like you said, we've seen charismatic talkers who really can't work at much have great runs. So what is the factor? So we glossed over that. But everywhere you go, whether it's running for mayor, whether it's running for governor, you won. And you were the reform or you were the independent.
Yep.
So you can make people like you.
Yeah.
But well, you're really good at making people hate you.
Hate you.
You don't think you could have had a successful babyface run? Because here's what I think. Superstar Billy Graham was, I think, like the DVD they made for him, was 20 years ahead of his time. Had Vince Sr. had the foresight, like kind of like what Vince McMahon did with me,
yeah,
you know, the double term with Brett, he would have been a monster baby had he let him run, but he drops the title to Backlund. He goes off the reservation, and it was never the same.
Yeah.
Could you have been a babyface because you can get people to vote for you?
I don't know.
Sell yourself.
I guess.
You make great arguments.
I guess. I never had the opportunity. It never rose.
But to me, my natural instinct was to be a heel.
Me too. I never wanted to be a babyface.
I didn't either.
Never.
I had a great run, but I didn't want it.
Never. I didn't want it. Never was, except for the situational short time with Buddy Rose where we split the team up. And we went our separate ways. But other than that, I was always a villain, always wanted to be one. Didn't want to be Mom Apple Pie and the girl back home because I just felt that wouldn't allow me to create like I wanted
to create. But also, back in that day, you couldn't have got away with some of the stuff that I was getting away with, which was considered cool. Or I was very abrasive, but I had a very physical work style. But I was talking so much trash, it was entertaining people. Back in that day, it was more traditional. The business hadn't evolved to where it had in, say, 96, 97.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. That's like when people say to me, who's the greatest wrestler of all time? I go, you can't answer that.
You can't.
I always remember this year in the Olympics when Bella Karolyi, the gymnastics coach, they started to pin him down on that girl today or Nadia Comaneci. And Bella was great. He said, that's impossible. He said, they're two different eras. You cannot compare two different eras. Both were unique in their own way. And wrestling's the same way. You can't name, like, and say Hulk Hogan's the greatest ever, or Bruno was the greatest ever, or Steve Austin's the greatest ever. They were the greatest for their era.
Right.
And you have to, just like baseball, Henry Aaron, home run king, you know, Babe Ruth, home run king.
Right.
That's their own era of time when they do it. And because one actually beats the other in number, well, there's a lot of things that could cause that. You know, the ball's livelier, it flies farther, who knows, you know, whatever it could be. That's the reason you can never make comparisons between decades to decades, because it's a different time, it's a different place, and different elements in place, and how the business was perceived.
When you first came into WWF, what year was that? Because that was the old man running the territory.
In 81.
81.
Yeah.
What was the difference between, and everything evolves, but still, it was pretty specific. Between the old man and Vince taking it over when his dad sold the territory to him, my question is, what is the difference between the old man and working with Vince?
Well, the difference was, as a promoter, the old man was the smoothest ever. He
I heard that.
You could go into him. I went into him so angry one day, went in, met with Vince Sr., walked out, achieved nothing, and felt good. And and 10 minutes later, I was pissed again because I thought, he schmoozed me. I got nothing, and yet I left like I won. You know? And I didn't. The kid didn't have something he didn't have that the old man had. The old man could, like I said, give you nothing, and you felt he gave you the world.
Right.
And I don't know how he did it. He just, his whole persona and, you know, his gentlemanly, never raised his voice. He was the complete opposite of any. The old man never, ever talked loud. In fact, he always had his own villains that passed on his bad news.
Yeah.
Never came from him. He had other people that would give the bad news out or anything. But, and then, of course, though, to side with Vinny, the kid, the old man kept his allegiance to the old promoters and all that stuff.
Right.
When Vinny came along, Vinny was good, and I'll call him Vinny as opposed to Vince Sr., because he had a dream and a vision. And he wanted, maybe he wanted to beat his dad. I don't know. Maybe it was, you know what? I'm going to take this colossal great thing my father created, and I'm going to be Dr. Frankenstein and take it to a level that my dad would never have dreamed it could have gotten to. And he did. I give Vince credit. He's the P.T. Barnum of the generation. And, you know, and one thing about Vince, he'll gamble, too, the year we did football and all that.
I want to ask you,
he'll roll the dice.
Real quick on promoters, though, working with Geigel, Don Owen in Portland,
Ed Francis in Hawaii, Vern Gagne in Minneapolis, and Vince Sr. in New York.
Give me a common thread of all those guys operating, and if you're in there for any kind of period of time, as far as psychology of trying to keep all the boys in a state of everything's cool, because, you know, with the egos and...
The common thread between all of them?
Okay, here's the
they screw line. The boys over. That's the common thread. They all have their own ways. They all have their own techniques, but essentially they're doing the same thing.
But you give it to Vince Sr. for being the smoothest operator.
Oh, he was the smoothest operator. Like I said, Steve, I wish you'd have gotten a chance to work for him. Yeah. You'd have walked in so angry over something, and you'd have walked out feeling he solved the whole thing. And then 10 minutes later, you realized he didn't solve anything.
But
he just got me out of the office and got me off my high horse, and he accomplished what he needed to get done.
But I'll give you something, because you didn't deal with him in your later years, because you'd already been through the business and worked and moved on. But Vince Jr., he assumed those qualities, because I had many dealings with him, but I was on the same page with him. One time we had a meeting at catering, and it was one of those things where everybody gets together is to, you know, put the rally caps on and get the morale up. And anybody have any questions? One particular person stood up and asked a question, and I don't remember the question, but it was so basic, you knew what the answer was going to be. And Vince spun that person around, and just, you could see the cycle going.
Oh, yeah.
And then the person goes, okay, and sits down, and everybody in the room except that person knew that they had got hoodwinked, and they witnessed it firsthand. So I've seen many cases of it, I've heard other guys say the same things about going in to see the old man, and all of a sudden, everything's hunky-dory, fine.
Oh, yeah.
The door slams. You can't go back. And 5 seconds later, I didn't get anything accomplished.
You know what the greatest compliment I was ever paid?
I've heard this. What was it?
Freddie Blassie.
Yes.
Classy Fred Blassie.
You call your own shots.
Yep. Freddie, one day, apparently, when I was at the height of the whole Saturday night main event, I had my own dressing room. Never asked for it, but all of a sudden I got a dressing room with my name on it and all this. And I heard Freddie stood up one day with the boys and says, there's only one guy in this whole territory that calls his own shots with Vince, and that's Jesse Ventura. And I can't tell you, you know, having known old grumpy Freddie Blassie, if you ever met him.
But I did.
Freddie, that's the greatest compliment Fred could have ever given me, and he'll always be dear in my heart. More so than managing me was for when he said that there's only one guy that calls his own shots with Vince.
We used to go to the garden, and Freddie would show up. You know, and he's getting on up there, but I always have conversations with him. And God, just the respect. And he had this charisma about him, as you know.
Yeah,
like you said, for a guy like that to put you over.
Yeah.
And some of the things I've done when a veteran will put you over and say, that was good. It doesn't mean anything about tickets sold. It's if that person has validated what they thought about you.
Yeah, it's for Freddie to say that. That was always made me pride to say, for an old-timer to say that.
I read that you never, ever signed a contract with WWF. And that you never took a piss test.
Never.
Did everybody else sign a contract?
I guess. I didn't look out for everyone else. We're independent contractor. Vince,
so to speak.
Wait, Vince.
I know you're regretful.
Vince, wait. Vince is lucky I didn't go for the Senate, because had I gone into the Senate, I would have started a senatorial investigation as to why pro wrestlers are called independent contractors when they're not. You work for one company. They order you around. They control your whole life. How are you possibly an independent contractor, except for they don't have to pay your Social Security? That's why.
Right.
And so Vince is lucky that I never got to the Senate, because I would have investigated that, because to me, look at the thousands of dollars it's cost all of us wrestlers to have to pay 15% or whatever it is as an independent contractor on our taxes. That's a bee that's been under my saddle since I began wrestling. I thought, we are not independent contractors. I can't work for another promoter on Wednesday and then work for you on Friday. It don't work that way. How are we independent contractors?
You brought up the idea of a union way back in the day. What was it, 84?
It was right before WrestleMania 2.
Okay.
Because I left and did Predator and became part of the Screen Actors Guild. And before I signed with Vince, I told him, don't worry about union, Vince. I got mine.
Okay.
If they don't want it, that's their fault.
But when you brought up the idea, did you have any design on how it'd be run? What you would try to accomplish?
All I did... It was WrestleMania 2. 2 weeks before it, all the publicity had gone out. The advantage was ours. See, Jesse Ventura studies business. The advantage was ours. I waited so there was no agents around. I stood up in the dressing room, and I gave a speech to the boys. And this was at the time we were still battling Charlotte. And I said, if we go together and simply tell the media, we are not wrestling unless union negotiators by federal law come in and give us the opportunity to unionize. I said, guys, the people that turn on the lights in these buildings are union. I said, they have to do it by law. It's in our favor. Then if we engage the Charlotte guys to do the same thing, we can have a union in wrestling. I gave this big speech. I left it there. I went home. The next night, I got a call from Vince, who basically threatened to fire me if I ever brought it up again, and read me the riot act. And I then went and did WrestleMania 2 and immediately left and did Predator and was a member of the Screen Actors Guild now, my union that I get retirement from now, health care from, all of that from. So when I came back to Vince, I told him point blank, Vince, I won't ever bring up union again. I said, if these guys are too stupid to fight for their rights, I have my union now. I'm a member of the Screen Actors Guild. I get health care. I get retirement. I get everything from them. I'll pay my union dues. You won't hear from me. Well, then when I sued Vince, we had to depose him. And on the way out, I told my lawyer the story. And in deposition, you can bring up anything. And I said, if you can, David, find out who ratted me. I said, find out who ratted me that day, because it was one of the boys, because there were no agents there. Yeah. And so we got in there, Vince, and my attorney was great. He says, Mr. McMahon, he said, has there ever been a union in wrestling? Vince, no. Anyone ever try to form one? Vince sat a minute. He says, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I think Jesse Ventura spouted his mouth off about it once years ago. And my attorney goes, well, how do you know that? Did you hear him? No. Well, how did you know he spouted his mouth? He didn't even hesitate. Hulk Hogan told me. I was sitting in the chair and at a deposition.
You didn't sell it.
Well, at a deposition, you can't talk.
Right.
And you got to be. I was there. It was like someone punched me in the face. This was my friend. And I thought, Hogan betrayed me. Hogan called Vince and ratted me. Was an office stooge. In my day, that's what they were called. That was a low life, an office, somebody who reports to the office in the old days. And it stunned me. Stunned me. I sat there in the chair and I couldn't even think that it was Hogan. And then Vince admitted it on Larry King, too. And there's no reason for him to lie. He's under sworn oath. And then Hogan continued to lie about it and said he didn't do it. And I've never spoken to him since, and I don't care to, because he sold, in my opinion, Hogan sold me out. And then I found out in the trial why.
Why?
Well, in the trial, we got the records of WrestleMania 3, the big one,
right. Him
and Andre. Well, Hogan made more money than all of us combined, including Andre. If you took the payoffs of Andre and the whole rest of the card, Hogan made more than we did. So naturally, he didn't want a union.
Right.
That could even out the money a little bit more. And when I saw that he made more than Andre and all of us combined, then the picture was crystal clear to me. That he sold us out because he was getting taken care of and he didn't want nobody else horning in on the good deal he had.
How was going back in 2009 when you were the general manager for Night of Monday Night Raw and you got a chance to interact with Vince?
Yeah.
A couple of promos, and then you did color on a match.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, y'all clicked right back into the old gear.
For me, I took it as that when they flew me there, I turned to my son, because my son came with me that night, and I turned to him and I said, Ty, I said, please bear with me tonight, but this is an opportunity for one night for me to go back and be who. And so did you notice I villained it?
Yes.
Everyone was going to cheer me, and I right away turned and went villain. I did that on purpose. I said, I want to be the old Jesse. And so I went there and went against all the baby crap and went total villain. And what it did, it gave me a fleeting moment of enjoyment of what it used to be. It's like anything in life when you leave something and you never do it again. Rarely do you get an opportunity to relive the feeling. And that's what it gave me for that one night to relive the feeling.
But how was it going back, you know, after the lawsuits, after all the BS, you know, at the union?
To me, it was business.
Just business.
Just business. Vince was treating me fine. We were both scratching each other's back. I can't complain about Vince because here's the thing I'm embarrassed over, Steve, and I think you were part of this. The biggest payday I ever received in wrestling was when I refereed the match in Minneapolis. Was governor. 98 or 99 it was. 99. And what I say, I'm embarrassed over that. As a wrestler, how can I say my biggest payoff was being a referee? I'm a wrestler. Referees, come on. Those are the old washed-up guys or the guys who couldn't wrestle in the first place and want to be in the business. No offense to the referees. Yeah. But here I'm getting the biggest payoff I've ever gotten in my life, and it's because I'm a frickin' ref. You know, that part of it was tough to take. The money was great. You know, it overshadowed it.
I'm glad you brought that up because here's something that happened during that match, and I don't know if you know about this to this day. So I was a part of that match. It was me.
Yeah, six men. Yeah,
Triple H.
Yeah.
In a triple threat match.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate those kind of matches.
I'd never seen one before, yeah, so it was new to me.
I loved tag team wrestling when I was with Brian.
Sure.
Come to love it. But I was always like a singles guy.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're in this triple threat. And I think Shane McMahon came ringside. And I was standing on the bottom rope. And he came by the ring. I took a swipe at him. And when I did, this was the first night. That was the first night that I started wearing the double knee braces. I used to wear one,
okay,
but now I was wearing double because the knees were so bad. Well, I tipped over and went upside down, and when I did, I hung myself in the ropes. So I'm hanging upside down by my legs. There's no way I can right myself back up. And so something just happened. Maybe it was something you did with Shane, but all of a sudden you go into a strut, and I'm hanging upside down. I can't ask Mick or Triple H to, hey, help me out. I can't get out here.
Sure.
So as you're strutting, I'm hanging upside down going, Jesse, Jesse, Jesse. And you're caught up in the moment. We've got 20,000 people there. I'm hanging upside down on the top baby face in the world, and I'm screwed. And so finally, Triple H and me, who always had such a...
I don't even remember.
I know you didn't. But Triple H, he writes me up, and he had no business doing so because he's a heel.
Sure.
And this is one of those moments, every now and then I'll botch a high spot or something with Triple H, who I loved working with. And right away, I had to start punching him like, God dang it, God dang it, God dang it. But I'm using the other word.
Sure.
And we went to a whole high spot. But it was so embarrassing. It was just friggin' believable. And I'm like, Jesse, I'm just waiting. Man, you took care of me in 92 and down in WCW. Help me out in 99 and get me back on my feet.
I don't even remember it.
I know.
Yes. I had the enjoyment that night. What I really took pride in, as referee, I actually backed down China that night.
Really?
Yeah. She backed up from, she sold me. And remember, China wasn't taking crap from nobody then.
She was over strong.
Yeah. She was over big, but I got along well with her. I was really saddened when I learned she died.
I know.
I was really, because, you know, she had a background, but she was very fair to me, and she, I liked her.
I did
really
too.
Enjoyed her. She was a strange woman, you know, but an unbelievably good talent.
All right, let's give big ups to Geico for being a loyal sponsor of the Steve Austin Show. Go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you can be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at geico.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. All right, let's get some props to our friends at True Car for supporting the podcast from day one. True Car knows that every car comes with its share of stories. That ding in your bumper from when you attempted to park somewhere in Los Angeles, or the mileage you saved by taking a bus all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with True Car, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell it or trade it in. Just go to True Car, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then just answer a few questions. Navigation, moonroof, spacious trunk. This way, you'll know how much of a hit it's going to be so you can plan ahead. Once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out True Car today. True cash offer not available in all areas. Hey, man, you're going to need some car insurance for that vehicle. Go to Geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you can be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at Geico.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. Don't forget to rate and review the Steve Austin Show on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends to check us out. And if you want to reach me here on the podcast, send an email to questions@steveaustinshow.com. Don't forget, my new show, Straight Up Steve Austin, airs right after Monday Night Raw. Please make sure you tune in or set your DVRs. Hey, I got a badass beer. It's the best IPA in the United States of America. And it's really, really something you need to try. From El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find it at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in SoCal. If you're not in SoCal, check online and see if you can find some place that will send it your way. I got some badass pocket knives from Cold Steel, The Broken Skull, and The Working Man. Find them at my Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. Also, if you see me out there riding in the woods, you can bet your ass I'll be riding a Kawasaki. I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially True Car, Geico, and BetOnline.ag. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. And if you need more info on my sponsors, check out the show description to this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, @SteveAustinBSR. Until next time, folks, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.